Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast. I'm Chris Wagner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News. I am joined in the studio by the man, the myth, Christopher Wynn, deputy editor for FD, the style magazine of the Dallas Morning News. Hello, Chris.
Hello. I feel like we need a cheering crowd soundtrack for that. Thanks.
Ask and you shall receive. Also joining us, as always, is Lauren Smart, the arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer. What's up, Lauren?
Hey, does that make me the legend?
That makes you the woman, the myth, Lauren
the legend.
Smart. The legend.
Oh.
There we go.
Nice.
Brian Elledge with some audience.
Nice one, Brian.
Very nice. So I makes the big bucks. Yeah. On today's show, we review the new film Straight Outta Compton about the LA gangster rap group NWA. Next, Dallas Morning News intern Emma Court joins us to discuss her essay for the Modern Love column in last Sunday's New York Times, A Millennial's Guide to Kissing. And finally, Colon Talk with Christopher Wynn, digital separation anxiety. C-Dub went under and went off the grid and kind of had an existential crisis. And we'll dig deep into that, so to speak.
I think that's a new podcast, Colon Talk.
Colon Talk with Christopher Wynn.
I would not listen to
that. I would so not. I might listen to it once.
Right.
Just to get like a flavor for what it was all about. Wynn, do you have some story that you'd
yes,
like to tell?
I had a funny podcast moment this week. I was talking to a friend who was telling me that he has a new friend who moved here recently. And the friend has been overdosing on Dallas media, trying to figure out what to do and where to go. And he was like, oh, and, you know, Dallas News, and there's this Culture Map website, and there's this podcast that's all about Dallas, and it has, like, this guy C-Dubs. He was like, wait, C-Dubs? He's like, yeah. He's like, yeah, I know him. It's like CW.
Do people outside of our podcast call you CW?
Friends and family.
Okay.
Yeah.
My brother-in-law, his name is CW.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I just remember thinking that was very strange when we started calling you that.
Does he spell it like C-D-U-B?
No, it's just C capital W capital. Like, it's very, yeah. It's a strange name.
You know, UPN and the WB merged and formed the CW.
That's right. Yeah.
Bring it all back to the cultural realm. And now we will get started with the show.
So when I'm in your neighborhood, you better duck down. Cause Ice Cube, a damn show, fuck him down. As I leave, believe I'm stomping. But when I come back, boy, I'm coming straight out of Compton.
That is most definitely the radio edit, Straight Outta Compton by NWA. The new movie, Straight Outta Compton, the NWA story, is out in theaters now. We all saw it. It is produced by, among others, Dr. Dre and Ice Cube, who are also the core members of NWA, with Eazy-E, otherwise known as Eric Wright, the late, great Eazy-E. Rest in peace. Curious to hear what you guys think about Straight Outta Compton. It is pretty much the definition of my wheelhouse. I've just been drooling over the idea of this movie for a while now.
Yeah, you've been excited about this one.
I have been very excited. I remember buying the album and just saying, oh my God, this is like different. This is really angry and raw and shocking. And I expected the Vice Squad to come into my room and take away my cassette from me. And now they have their own mainstream Hollywood biopic.
And you have the t-shirt, which you're wearing right now.
I am, in fact, wearing my Straight Outta Compton album cover t-shirt. Yes, very proudly.
Well, you wear it well.
I will point out. Thank you, C-Dubs. So what did you guys, as people who I'm guessing are not quite as fanatical about NWA and hip-hop, curious to know what you guys thought of this opus?
You know, it was interesting for me because when NWA came out, I, you know, my friends were listening to, you know, George Michael and Guns N' Roses and Def Leppard. You know, Madonna's Like a Prayer came out the following year. So that album just exploded. It was just so raw and obscene. It had the age restriction label,
parental guidance
on it, which just felt naughty, you know, kind of picking it up at the record store and looking at it. And actually, Lauren, we were talking about that a little bit earlier, when the stickers went on.
Yeah, well, that's sort of like the way I walked away from this movie, is thinking, first of all, I thought it was very good, and the acting was all really good, the actors all look or appear to look very similar to the people they're portraying.
Well, Ice Cube's son plays him.
Right. So there's that.
Can I admit that I did not know that was his son?
You just did.
Going into it, I was struck by how uncanny the appearance was and how it was a great performance. And then,
yeah, I saw on Jimmy. He said on Jimmy Kimmel he actually made his son audition for the role.
So good.
I thought that was funny.
Got to earn it.
But I think that for me, this movie was very much just a product of the year that it was made in, the year it came out in, and sort of everything, like capturing an unfortunate like problem that still exists today was something that they were facing in the late 80s, early 90s. And that was sort of the idea that they were black and therefore they were discriminated against. And that's sort of where that raw anger comes from in their music. And I didn't know any of their story before I saw this movie, so I was really glad to know it afterwards.
Yeah, not just discriminated against, but routinely harassed,
right,
by
harassed
the police on a nonstop basis for being young and black. Just the assumption that you're gangbanging if you're young and black.
Even just that opening scene with a drug deal gone bad, and then here comes the LAPD with like a
that was a badass battering ram.
Wow, yeah.
You know, punching through the front of the house. I mean, that's one way to kick off a movie.
That is one smash bang opening to a film.
Yeah. What's interesting though is the effect they had. An interesting fact I saw later was that 80% of the sales of that album went to suburbs at the time. That kind of went beyond the boundaries of black neighborhoods. And there's something interesting about that whole other world of kids and teenagers being exposed to the realities of life in the ghetto. And you know, it was interesting to see that brought to life in the film.
And that was one of the, you know, controversies at the time, was that, oh no, these poor innocent white kids are being invaded by these evil Negroes from the inner city. And, you know, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but that was a big part of it.
That was kind of the vibe.
That's why parents were freaking out so much. And then NWA really did help break hip hop into the mainstream world in that sense. I remember hearing it at the time and saying, you know, rock and roll can't shock you anymore. And I still kind of think that rock and roll is not going to piss off your parents anymore. This will piss off your parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that. It gets back to the sort of perspective I had leaving the movie, was that there was a whole story they didn't really even address about. And they talk about it vaguely, but the First Amendment rights that these rappers, I mean, and accidentally ended up fighting for. Their music was so in your face and so not what parents across America were used to, that like there was an entire Supreme Court battle led by Tipper Gore with her organization, the Parents Music Resource Center, that eventually led to that parental advisory sticker. And that doesn't really get addressed in the movie. They tend to focus a little bit more on the stories of the characters, which I think is the heart of the movie, and a little bit more on, you know, the harassment that was being was against them with the police. So
yeah, anytime you get a warning letter from the FBI,
right?
Yeah, that was a dramatic scene in the movie where the police actually, they threatened them not to perform their song called F the Police, and then NWA did it anyway, and then they were arrested. And
what is this F that you speak of? No,
we're a family podcast.
To Lauren's point, yeah, I mean, it's a problem for the rock biopic, for the music biopic in general, trying to cram in this case, you know, if it may drop a name, I spoke with Ice Cube earlier today, right before we started.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Actually, yeah.
Awesome.
He threw that out right before the podcast. I was like, I'm sorry, did you say you were just talking to Ice Cube?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Cube.
Cube.
But yeah, I mean, he kind of talked about the problem of trying to cram 10 years into 2.5 hours. And sometimes some of these biopics try to cram even more than that into even shorter period of time. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes you really want something, you know, like Lauren was saying, a story about the censorship battle or a story about the police conflicts. I think what we end up with often, for better or worse, is kind of the whole thing.
And right.
There was a lot of plot going on, especially in the second half of this movie. Mm-hmm.
I think for me, after they broke up and they all started going into their own separate acts and careers, that was for me when the movie started to drag a little bit. Because the movie is 2 hours and 20 minutes long.
It's long.
27.
Yeah. 2.5 hours long.
Don't discount those 7 minutes.
Well, and you have moments where, like, Dr. Dre's younger brother is killed, and that's like a blip in the movie. And then the 30 minutes of pool parties and,
right.
you know, bouncing derrieres.
I mean, I'm thinking of something, say Capote, something really mm-hmm. not much in common with N.W.A., tells a very specific chapter of Truman Capote's life. And I think it's more powerful because of that. There's a Miles Davis movie that's coming out later this year with Don Cheadle that also tells a very specific moment late in his career. Sometimes those movies have a little more impact than mm-hmm. the whole kit and caboodle kind of approach.
Right. And there was sort of that moment they drove home, and rightly so, the Rodney King incident, you know, that was really played up in the film, and that has obvious parallels to today with Ferguson and everything going on. But I thought it was an interesting contrast that they had, you know, you're seeing the 1991 TV footage of the Rodney King incident, and then moments later you have Suge Knight is, right. you know, pummeling a guy in the parking lot because he parked in his space. And I thought that was an interesting contrast of...
That was the moment when Dre was like, this guy might be psychotic.
Yeah, I should probably get out of this deal.
Reconsider this.
But to that point, I think you see the Rodney King footage four or five times in right. the movie. And then I also think they did... And I think this is partially related to the fact that Ice Cube's company produced the film. Mm-hmm. They do a very long, touching, but long, drawn-out tribute to Eazy-E at the end. I mean, 15 minutes at least right. were dedicated to the end of his life, which just felt a little bit... it seemed to bog down and could have been compacted.
There's a sense that Cube and Dre are kind of dotting their I's and crossing their T's mm-hmm. and checking off the things that they feel are really important. And that's their producers, so right. that's their prerogative. But yeah, I also felt that went on a little bit. Then again, it's, you know, a rap star dying of AIDS. That was a really big deal
right.
Back then, especially.
One thing I was struck with was... you've seen the foundation of this band, these boys who were victims of poverty, you know, of their upbringing, you know, dealing with gangs every day. I mean, there's a guy with a gun who pulls over the school bus that Ice Cube is on, you know, it's
and then
intense.
Gives a motivational speech.
Right.
It's a great scene.
Quote, motivational speech. But it's interesting how even as they grew up and had money and found success, that way of looking at the world persisted for them. You know, if somebody needed to sign a contract or get out of a deal, you know, send in the thugs. You know, we're going to get you out of it. It was interesting to see how they could transcend their circumstances, but in some way they couldn't completely let go of the world they had grown up in.
And now they've, I mean, Dre is almost a billionaire.
Right.
And Ice Cube is...
Thanks, Apple.
This kind of family entertainment mogul, mm-hmm. which is just so unlikely. So they really transcended mm-hmm. in that sense. They are very much the mainstream now.
And it did seem like that was where the movie kind of left you when the end of it, when Dr. Dre's leaving his record company with Suge Knight. It's like, this. What does he say? I'm going on to start my own company, and his new company is called
Aftermath.
Right. So I really enjoyed
dun, 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 dun.
But you know what I really yeah. loved that, I mean, I didn't really grow up with this music. I grew up in white suburban Plano. So I had parents who...
Straight out of Plano.
Yeah, straight out of Plano.
Yeah, completely.
So
there's your meme.
This wasn't something that I was really allowed to participate in, but the music is amazing. I mean, just hearing it loud at the movie theater, I was blown away. I got in my car and turned it on, you know, on Spotify. And I don't know. I really enjoyed hearing the music so loud.
Yeah, they're definitely worth going in the big screen for that aspect of it, for sure. The only question I had actually for Lauren was, I wonder, as a woman, how you feel about the music, the message, you know, is it, you know.
And the fact that the movie really did kind of gloss over a lot of things. Like Dr. Dre assaulted a
right.
female TV personality, and it barely gets mentioned in the movie.
I thought the whole, I mean, on the one hand, I thought it probably was a fairly accurate portrayal. They didn't really shy away from the misogyny of the tour. There was a point, I think, even when one of the members of the band said something like, "We got to get all the bitches in here." You know, there was very much. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's Ice Cube's song, A Bitch is a Bitch.
Yeah, it's very aware of the misogyny. That being said, they didn't seem to make any value judgment of the misogyny, whereas I felt like the rest of the movie was making value judgments about the decisions they made and what happened and where it went and what it became. I felt like that was sort of, yeah, glossed over. I mean, there were a lot of naked women at pool parties and in hotel rooms and doing a lot of things, you know, a lot of sexual favors for these men, and these women are never given a voice. Even the wives in the movie and the girlfriends
right.
are barely... You even see them they're almost making, you know, appearances in these men's, meaningful appearances in these men's life. And they're very much props and glossed mm-hmm. over. So that was kind of frustrating, but probably fairly accurate.
So yeah. Overall, we liked the movie.
Definitely a thumbs up.
Totally enjoyed it, yeah.
Straight Out of Compton in theaters now. We will be right back.
The villain. The definition is clear, you're the witness of a killing. It's taking place without a clue. And once you're on the scope, you know you're through. Look, you might take it as a trip, but a brother like Brand is on a gangster tip straight out of Compton.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
Dallas Morning News intern Emma Court had an essay in the Sunday New York Times this week. I will admit that I'm kind of jealous about that. it's called A Millennial's Guide to Kissing. And she's going to join us right now to tell us about how this came about. Hey, Emma, how are you?
Hello.
So what can you tell us about A Millennial's Guide to Kissing?
Well, first of all, I just want to put out there that I didn't choose the title. The copy editor wrote it.
Here comes the controversy.
Copy editors.
I think it's a great title for the purposes of a newspaper and like clicking on it and reading it. And I'm thankful that they chose this title because I think a lot more people probably read it because of it. But like some of my close friends said, I don't know if like it's exactly the title I would have chosen.
It's not like a step-by-step
how to kiss a millennial. Yeah, I just feel like it's kind of a letdown. Kind of it's like, right. Oh, like this is how millennials kiss. And all these people like commented and were like, hey, I didn't learn any kissing tips, you know? I'm like,
I was looking to you, Emma, to teach me how
open
to
mouth,
kiss. Come on.
So what can you, what? Give us just a thumbnail of what you're talking about in this essay.
Yeah, so basically I went on Birthright in January. I just graduated from Cornell in May.
And what is Birthright?
Birthright is a free 10-day trip for American Jews to sort of reconnect with their identity. There's some like requirements. You can't have gone on like sort of a formal organized trip before, and you get to go there to Israel for 10 days for free, which is rad, and they take you around in this big bus and you see the country, and I'd sort of been meaning to do it for a while and like finally went my senior year, like right before my second semester of college, and was like, okay, cool, I'm gonna do this, like last chance, you know,
with and, lots of other cute young people on
well,
the trip with
maybe
you.
Not on my trip. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sorry to whoever's listening to this.
Right.
And this is your senior year.
Yeah. So yeah. So I'm, you know, kind of like, okay, like whatever, you know, we'll go do this. Nothing really happened on the trip. It was like fun. Like a lot of people on my trip had some like romantic adventures, and I was sort of like, okay, like just doing my thing. Like nothing's happening. Okay. and then I like spent a few extra days in Israel with some family friends and came back. On my return flight back, I met this boy who was sitting next to me on the airplane and had also been on Birthright, but didn't go to my school. And we kissed on the airplane.
I want to understand this more because in your essay, I wasn't sure if, you know, there's a moment where you describe it as sort of a surprise kiss in a way. And I wasn't sure if, like, you lock eyes and it happens, or you're sort of lying there looking at the ceiling and suddenly, boom, here it comes. What
somebody is kissing me.
Yeah.
Well, can I just say, though, I remember when I was in college and I studied abroad, I, like, hoping that something really romantic would happen. I think it, when you're in college and you're on these trips by yourself, effectively, you're with people, but you're with other young people, and I think you kind of are looking for that in the first place, right?
I mean, I definitely, like, I'm not going to say I was, like, disappointed that nothing had happened on my trip because, like, there was nobody to happen. But, like, you always kind of, when you go on, like, this big trip, you're like, oh, maybe something interesting will happen. Not that you, like, expect a stranger to kiss you on an airplane, because I, like, definitely didn't expect that.
Oh, my God.
Was that a drop?
That was Brian again.
Nicely done.
Yeah.
But you kind of, you want something to happen. Like, it would be fun. It would make life more interesting. It would give you a good story. So, I mean, it wasn't like, I guess it was
so
like,
the kiss, yes.
It wasn't like entirely unexpected. Like, I mean, afterwards I was like, whoa, that was surprising. He was like, was it really? And I was like, oh, I guess not. But I mean, it was because it was like, I mean, who does that? Like, first of all, like, I'm a little embarrassed for myself because, like, that's inappropriate in a public place. But, like, it's also, like, a weird setting. There were, like, other people around. I mean, we had, like, each of us had, like, a friend from our trip sitting, like, one row behind us, sort of, like, diagonally across the aisle. It was, like, literally, like, what is this? Like, are we, like, 12 years old? Like, this is so...
How long had you guys been talking before the kiss?
I guess for, like, probably at least an hour
okay.
or two. Well,
that's a respectable amount of time to build up to it.
No shame there.
Yeah.
Isn't there also like an age-old idea that, you know, when you're up in the air, things are more romantic? Isn't there a whole George Clooney movie?
Yeah, I called it up in the air when I submitted it, but they didn't care for the title.
That's actually, I like that better than
Wanting
this guy to kiss.
And it kind of speaks to the how things evolved a little bit too, which speaking of, what did kind of happen
after
that?
What happened next?
So I'm sure I'll shock you all because you haven't read it at all, but...
Oh, we have actually.
Yeah, I know. I figured.
Oh, I see.
So then sort of we like, it was weird because it was like, you're up in the air for like 12 hours and you're next to this person and you don't have your phone on, you know, you can't, you could like watch a movie. And I was like reading a book and he was like sort of sleeping, but like, it was sort of like, after that, it was like, well, we clearly weren't going to like fall asleep for the rest of the flight. So we like kept talking and it was like weird because it felt like in these like 12 hours we had become like really tight, right? And had never known each other before and then we're never going to see each other again. And I remember like thinking in my head, I was like, I wonder what will happen after this. Like, that's kind of, that'll be interesting. And then we get to Newark. I'm like going back to school. He's going back to school. Our trains were literally going in different directions. And we sort of said goodbye at the train station. And like, I remember thinking like, I was like, should we get each other's numbers? And I was like, nah. And then we just like said goodbye and it was like pretty weird. And he said sort of jokingly, like called down the stairs as he was walking away, see you never. And I was like, oh, that's
romantic.
Mean. That's horrible.
I couldn't decide if that, yeah, is that mean? Is it romantic?
I think it's romantic in the sense that I think romance doesn't have to have a happy ending. Mm-hmm. And that's what I liked about your story is like you get to the point where you're talking about how you connect on Facebook later and you kind of just, it just lingers and nothing, you know, that's life. There's no closure in life, right?
Yeah. That's true. I guess I really like that what you just said about romance not having to be like happily ever after. Mm-hmm. But it sucked. I'm not gonna lie. Like it was, I was just like, I mean, I get that you're like a little bit younger than me, and like I would never have said that to you. I don't think. But it was not ideal. And then so later, like you said later, like sort of I saw him on his name on my Facebook, and I like you know couldn't resist, and sort of was like okay like. And I add him on Facebook, and he messaged me. And I remember getting the message because I was with my friends, and we were, like, ice skating, and we were taking off our skates. And I was like, you will never guess what just happened, guys. So we're talking, and I just really didn't enjoy it at all. I don't know if you guys, like, I feel like everyone's had this experience where you're sort of, like, something else is lingering, and you don't, like, and you're in a different place, and it just doesn't feel like it makes sense, or, like, it felt, like, weird, and... It sort of felt like I was wasting my time a little bit, or like both of us were, or like, I don't know. It felt very unresolved and I just didn't enjoy it. And then.
Well, in an old movie, in a movie with, you know, Cary Grant or Katharine Hepburn, you guys wouldn't have connected on Facebook, but, you know, 50 years later,
on the top of the Empire
State
Building.
Run into each other, right?
Yeah.
And so I think Facebook, and this is sort of like the idea of the millennial, Facebook has put us in a situation where that can't happen because. The next time you're in the same city, you'll both know.
Yeah.
You know, you won't bump into each other. Right. That, like, that singular moment of serendipity won't happen again.
Yeah. And that was sort of, I guess, what struck me about the whole thing was, like, we have access to so much communication that we can communicate with, like, whoever we want, more or less, right, with, like, some boundaries on that. And it's, like, how we decide who we prioritize and how we go about that. It's, like, we're making these, constantly making these decisions all the time. And, like, what strikes me is it never feels like anything I'm doing, like, is sort of guided by happenstance or coincidence in the same ways. So I don't know. I thought that was very odd that, like, you know, in a movie, like, it's possible to have a missed connection, a truly missed connection, because you couldn't, like, use social media in the same way as you do today. And to a certain extent, it feels like, as a, you know, a person growing up in this day and age, like, it would have been a lot more romantic to have had sort of the coincidence and the, you know, like, that would have been such a great, you know, we met on a steamboat, right? In the back in the old day, we would have met on a steamboat and, like, you know, then, like, parted ways and, like, you know, he would have known, like, where I went to school and, like, maybe he would have come, like, find, you know, right, found me. But instead it was, like, on Facebook we were messaging. Like,
well,
that's
now
so
it's like you meet on profile a lot of times. It's like you get to know someone's profile and then you get to know them after.
Yeah. I mean, well, who we are on social media has become so entangled with who we are in real life. Like, I just, it's so bizarre to me. Like, I looked at his Facebook and I was like, what? Like, if I had seen his Facebook before I had met him, like, I would have been, like, so, like, confused about the dichotomies there, you know?
Wild boar hunter? Wait a minute. I didn't see that coming.
I was like, you have a lot of likes on your profile pictures. What's that all about?
Right.
Yeah. Dating today is so obnoxiously intentional. It's like, you know,
swipe right.
Yeah.
Well, so there's this big article in Vanity Fair that came out, like, right when my essay came out. And I remember reading it and I was, like, so depressed, because it is basically, like, she follows, and, like, she uses anonymous sources, so I feel like you can take that as you will, but she follows these, like, it's clearly, like, rich finance, like, I'm gonna call them D-bags, like, you know, on Tinder in New York City. Like, I've been in that scene in the summers, like, I'm from New York, like, I know how that goes. Like, nothing really surprised me, but it was, like, incredibly, like, callous, and she really highlighted how, like, these dudes are all, like, on their phones, like, I mean, they don't speak for all of mankind, obviously, but, like, on their phones, like, swiping right, like, having casual sex, leading women on, like, to think that they would want something more and not, and then the women are all, like, we feel disposable, men don't even drive us home in the morning, like, right. If they text me, I'm shocked. Like, and it felt like, I mean, part of the reason I wrote this essay, like, I don't like having this out there in some ways, because it feels incredibly vulnerable in a way that my work, like, I write about, like, news and facts, and this is not facts. I mean, it's feelings. But I've felt like this for a while. Like, the way, like, her article is incredibly extreme, but, like, in college, I think, like, social media, like, heightens this divide where, like, I mean, there's always been misogyny and sexism and stuff, but I think, like, men and women are on very different footing in college.
So let's get to the real story here. How did you get this in the Sunday Times?
So there's a College Modern Love competition I guess it was in January, February. And so I got back from my trip, and then this was all happening right before the deadline for the contest. And I was like, I read Modern Love like a lunatic. Like, I scour the archives to see if there's anything that I've missed. If someone mentions a Modern Love that I haven't read yet, I get really excited. It, like, feels like a holiday for me. Like, so I was like, oh, this would be great to, like, you know, enter this contest. And I kind of felt like maybe I have a bit of a leg up, since I, like, want to be a writer, you know. So I submitted. I wrote this whole thing at, like, 3 a.m. one night. I was just, like, fueled on, like,
it's college
enthusiasm.
Yeah, hello. Yeah.
Yeah. And I wrote it and I submitted it. And then they decided, I didn't win, but they decided that they'd publish the top 10 entries, and I was in the top 10. So
awesome.
Has he read it? Has this guy read it?
Yeah.
Yes, that's what I'm dying to ask.
So they actually, I don't know if anyone knows this, but they kind of make you tell the people that are in it, like, if they're identifiable, and even if, I mean, he's not really identifiable, so even if they're not, they kind of, like, want you to let them know and give them a heads up. And I was incredibly nervous about doing this, so I, like, postponed it until the last bubble, because I've known since April, May, like, before I graduated college, that this was going to come out at some point. But I didn't want to, like, tell him, like, 7 months beforehand. So I waited until, like, 2 weeks before when I had just edited it and I knew what it would look like and I knew his name wouldn't be in it. And then I called him. And it was,
so, yeah, there's going to be this story. How did that go?
It was one of the most awkward phone conversations I've ever had in my life.
You kind of come off as a dick in it, but, you know.
Remember you said, see you never? Remember that?
Yeah. Remember when you were horrible? No.
Yeah.
I called him, and he was clearly, like, really confused. I mean, we hadn't talked. And
he was like, wait, who?
It was
the girl on the plane.
He sounded
totally.
Like he was asleep. Like,
which 12-hour flight?
Yeah. Which girl in the airplane did you make out?
Yeah, because I Tindered like two others in that same flight.
You probably got that like mid-bong hit or something.
So I was like, hey, how's it going? And then like we made awkward small talk for like half a second, but it was just so awkward. Like he had no idea why I was talking to him. I was like really mortified. And I was like, so the New York Times is publishing an essay I wrote about you. And he was like, oh, congrats. That was his first reaction.
Really?
And I was like, that's wow, nice. Okay. But I was also like, yeah, okay, cool, bye.
He's
like,
out.
Got off the phone as soon as I could.
See
but
you never.
He did ask to see it, so I sent it to him. And then, like, 2 days of radio silence, and I was like, oh, my God, like, he hates it. Like, he's going to call the New York Times and demand they not publish it. Like, this is going to be horrible. Like, and then I got, like, this text from him, like, 2 days later, and he was like, hey, period. I had a heart attack because I was, like, so nervous about this whole thing, and I'd just been on a run on the Katy Trail, and I stopped, and I got this hey text, and I was just like, my life is over.
Was he being smart, though? Because he said hey in the story, and then he's like, hey, in the text. Was he being?
I have never contemplated.
Am I giving him too much credit?
That's amazing. Yeah. I don't know. I'll take it.
More smart with the deep, close reading.
That's wonderful.
Today
this is, like,
thoughts.
English PhD level of analysis. I don't know, but I was like, what's up? Oh, just like in the piece. And then he said a lot of very nice things, including that, like, he thought I treated him really generously and that, like, it had really changed the way he thought about things and that he was, like, glad that this was going out there, basically. But I do know that he told me later that, like, some of his friends sort of figured out it was him and, like, yelled at him.
Oh.
Which, I'm sorry. I mean, like, I didn't write this to, like, punish him. Like, I'm not mad at him on the scheme of, like, bad
See,
things men have done to women. Like, this hardly ranks, you know? But, yeah. But it was, like, very cool that he was so thoughtful and nice about it, because I don't think, I sure as hell would have been like, what do you mean you're writing about me in the New York Times, you know?
That's what happens if you kiss a writer, I think. Yeah.
And now anyone you date from now on will have that.
Yeah.
Will be
well,
have good preparation
material.
Well,
I don't know if you've heard, but I'm a millennial expert on kissing.
I want to brag.
I hear you've written a guide to the subject.
Wait, no, one more question. Have you gotten any emails from people like,
I've had
like
so
guys
many weird
saying,
experiences.
Yeah, guys saying like, can we kiss? Can we meet up?
I did get one of those.
Okay. The stalkers have come out.
I have had all kinds of weird experiences because of this. Like, it's been a really odd week because I kept getting like Facebook messages in my other inbox, and of course I'm going to read them, right? But then it got to be too much. I couldn't even respond anymore because it was like, oh my God. Like, I was getting tweets. I was like, I got some emails. They forwarded me some of the emails from the New York Times, and someone wrote a poem.
Aww.
It was kind of cool.
Called See You Never?
No. Oh. It was like very abstractly related to what I had written about. It wasn't like explicitly
of
about
course,
it.
Of course, it's a poem.
One woman emailed me to tell me that I had to immediately go find him and tell him how I felt and like call him, Facebook him, text him. I don't care. Just tell him how you feel. And I was like, you're presuming a lot of things about like, like this happened 6 months ago. I had a guy who I had gone on one date with, like, a couple months ago, like, text me and be like, why didn't you write about our date?
Our date wasn't memorable enough to your New York Times piece?
It wasn't that
special. I was
special.
I just didn't really have anything to say about it, to be honest. I had a guy from freshman year of college who I think I met at a party. I don't even remember meeting him. I barely remember meeting him, and I barely remember that he had my number, but he texted me and was like, I just thought this was like very, like he was like, this is wonderful piece. And I was like, I feel like weird because I feel like you expect me to say like you were just like the boy on the airplane for me or something, but like it wasn't true. I don't know. Maybe I'm like, I get a little literary sometimes and I like assume too much, but there were like a lot of weird things like that. Mostly just Facebook messages. It's like, I mean, I thought it was cool because like a lot of women and like dudes wrote in saying that they like felt the same way and they felt that way about like hookup culture and stuff like that. And like, I was hoping people would like relate to it. So.
Well, congrats. It's a really good essay.
Yeah, beautifully written.
And you're in the Times. What are you, 21?
I am 21.
Wow. Good clip.
21 and a half.
Awesome. you can read Emma Court's essay, A Millennial's Guide to Kissing, not her headline, at nytimes.com.
I love the headline. I'm sorry.
She loves the headline.
Up in the air.
Really, New York Times. She's awesome with the headline. We will include a link on our show page at guylive.com/podcast. And you can also read Emma's work regularly at dallasnews.com. We'll be right back. Can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me? This is a segment we like to call Christopher's Colon.
Oh, God.
Welcome to Christopher's Colon. Our Christopher Wynn recently had a routine medical procedure, but it left him in an emotional tailspin when he found himself disconnected from everything. What happened, Christopher Wynn? You had a colonoscopy.
And somehow I let you talk me into doing this as a segment. But
you'll be grateful. You'll thank me later.
It's our PSA moment. So I had a colonoscopy. I'm young for that, but I actually was going in for an endoscopy. So I was going in for an endoscopy, and because I had some family history stuff, they were like, well, you might as well do both.
You're hanging out here. Why not get a colonoscopy?
Yeah, it made me realize it's kind of like going to the getting your car worked on or doing home renovations. There's that might as well syndrome. It's like, hey, we're ripping out the insulation to do this, so you might as well replace that. So they were going in, so why not do it all at one time?
Not to be crude, but aren't they two different ends?
They're two different ends. Yeah.
Did you know going in that they would be doing both when you arrived for the procedure? Okay.
Yes. No, I mean, you know, they plan it all out ahead of time and you schedule it in.
It wasn't a pop-up colonoscopy.
No, that would be very Dallas though. So I started, you know, getting ready for it, and you know, typical of life, I was too busy to read the instructions I had and everything. And the preparation process for this is the most intense part. You know, you have to kind of clean everything out, and they give you some horrible stuff to drink. And I had a busy day, got home at like 8 o'clock at night. I'm like, fine, I'll drink the stuff. Let's get this party started. And I realized after reading it that I was supposed to start like at noon that day. It's kind of this all day process. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going in at 7 a.m. So if I start now and I don't sleep at all, we can do this. We still got this. So that began the process of, you know, I hadn't eaten for 24 hours. In fact, this was last week when we did our last show. I had not had food all day. I'm a little loopy. I'm surprised I got through the show.
Oh, I couldn't
this
ex- tell.
I was going to say this explains a lot.
Yeah.
No. I was being kind.
Yeah. So became sleep deprived, couldn't eat, got a little weak, got a little loopy. But what happened is I began, and really what was the genesis for this episode was the fear of being off the grid began to really freak me out. So for the procedure, they put you out. You know, you're sedated. In fact, they gave me propofol. It knocks you completely out. So it's a serious thing. And I was having a panic attack with being out, you know, for however many hours, not having access to email or technology.
So this was how long before the actual procedure that you start freaking out?
The day before.
Wow.
Yeah. It begin to get real, and you know, it's a busy time at work. We have lots of deadlines. We have to post the show. I'm suddenly having to tie up lots of loose ends, and I realize I can't believe I'm going to be completely cut off from technology. you know, for 2-3 hours. And then I think, how sad is that? How pathetic is that? I should be happy to have a break and be able to have a time out. But that's where it began.
What do you do when you're on a plane? Do you get make sure you get Wi-Fi? Or,
you know, it's interesting. You know, there are those moments when you know, you don't have a signal, you are kind of cut off, but somehow it's different. In this case, it's like not only would I be cut off, but I literally would not know what was happening. I'm literally going to be unconscious for, you know, 2.5 hours. And it was a very weird and unsettling feeling. I don't know that I've ever been put under or put out like that before.
Does it come from, for me, a lot of that fear would come from a sense of feeling like I'm in control of my life at
right.
all times.
The illusion that we're in control.
Exactly. Yeah. So are you a little bit of a control freak?
Apparently, yes, is the answer. I don't know that I would have said that before, but yeah, I've got a lot of irons in the fire and it was kind of freaking me out. And what became more intense is it went from a fear of being disconnected from technology to a fear, to it became kind of a mortality issue. Life, death, I mean, you are literally, you were gone for 2 hours. And when you go into the procedure, you know, you have to sign all this paperwork about, you know, can we resuscitate you, can we not? You know, do you have your power of attorney? What's gonna, you know, is somebody here? I mean, you really have to kind of get in that mindset to go through the procedure. And it was interesting. I didn't feel like I was afraid of death or that I had an issue around that, but it put me in a weird headspace, and it made me realize that maybe I'm not ready.
I mean, the older we get, too, the more we start thinking about these things. I mean, by the way, I found out what I had when I was sick. I had strep throat.
Wow.
First test didn't pick it up. But mm-hmm. I wasn't unconscious, but I wanted to be
right.
at
yeah.
times. And you just start thinking, you know, wow, this is, I have 103 degree temperature here. What if something happens?
Right.
I'm only 45. I have so much left to do. And it's kind of melodramatic, but these thoughts start running through your head.
I was really, really sick in February. I had, among other things, like a kidney infection and a really severe cold and all these things. And I remember thinking, if I get better, I'm going to have to take better care of myself.
Right.
And I don't know if that's something that you thought to yourself. I mean, you probably take pretty good care of yourself at all times, but did you get out of it? Was there something you were like, okay, I'm going to survive this, and then tomorrow will be different? How?
Yeah, I did have that moment. And it's a thing of, it puts your life into hyper focus. Suddenly the things that matter to you, that are meaningful to you, become that more, all the more dear and precious to you. And the things that you worry about and think about become much more extraneous. And it does make you think about what am I here to do? What did I want to do? What did I mean to do? And how did I get off track? Or what do I still need to do? Who do I need to have closure with? And I wanted to use it as a moment to kind of galvanize and be like, all right, when this is over, if I come back on the table, you know, I'll do some things differently, or I'll change my focus a little bit. And what was interesting, and I'm kind of sad to report, is that once I kind of did come back, and by like the next day or so, and I began feeling better, it's like the minutia of life began kicking in again, and I lost some of that intensity around it.
I think that's healthy, though. I mean, you can't live your life in a state of existential crisis at all times.
Right.
That would be actually more traumatic than anything else that
right.
you're talking about.
Yeah, it's true. I'm curious how you feel about all this. You're glued to technology and everything else in life. I mean, do you ever have anxiety around being disconnected, about being unplugged?
Yeah, I mean, I like have been lately trying to get away from my phone, and it kind of, in this industry, it feels like you, by virtue of your occupation, can't unplug. Like, there are some
right.
people, like, I would love to get a flip phone. Like, everyone's like, no, you actually wouldn't want to. I know I probably wouldn't, because I love Google Maps and my Spotify app, but like, it feels like you can't get away from it. And like you said, like, you know, it's sad, but like, if I'm away from my phone for 2 or 3 hours and like I miss emails and stuff like that, like, I won't be like devastated, but like, it'll hurt me the next day. You know, like, I missed an email for 20 hours. Like, it got to me at work. I missed it somehow. And I responded today and I was like, God, if I had only responded it yesterday, like, we'd all be done with this. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. it's always this like now culture. But like, I'll like leave my phone. My roommates don't get this. Like, we'll go to like the grocery store and I'll leave my phone at home. Like, I'm with you. Like, I don't need to, like, who else do I need to talk to? And they'll of course lose me at the grocery store and we'll be like wandering the store right. looking. But it's like kind of nice to regain that, like, when you're little and you've gotten lost from your mom at the mall.
We were
feeling,
worried sick about you.
Right. Yeah. She was like, Emma, like, why didn't you just bring your phone? Like, come on. But I don't know. I guess like cultivating that like in like discreet spaces feels kind of nice. But like, I understand it when you were like on deadline and you have like things that you need to be doing, that like it's not the ideal time to be disconnected. And,
it's
like,
a forced disconnect.
Yeah. Right.
I have friends who take technology sabbaticals over the weekend. Mm-hmm. They're not daily journalists. but I think that's a really healthy thing to do. I kind of look at this person and I'm like, wow, how mm-hmm. do you do that? That's incredible. You don't check email or look at your phone to do anything but talk on it for 48 hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, I sort of have this theory. Okay, I read the statistic a couple weeks ago that the average millennial checks their phone habitually, and the number that they came up with was like 150 times a day.
Wow.
I bet I exceed that.
That's not surprising, really? Though, well, actually.
Yeah, I think that was just social media. I don't think it was text messages, phone calls, emails. But I have a theory that this is why we're seeing a rise in the need for and the psychological encouragement of meditation. That this mm-hmm. that because currently this is like the number one psychologist recommended tactic to deal with your anxiety is meditation, because in those however 15-20 minutes that you sit down to just be in the moment,
yeah,
you don't check your
the quiet
phone.
Mind.
That's why I was so pissed when the subway got like 3G. Because it used to be the only like, what
the
think
last
about,
space. Yeah.
The only places that you are ever away from your phone are the shower and like the subway. If you like,
I
live
have
in
a friend.
A
I have a millennial mm-hmm. friend who checks his phone in the shower.
Yeah, why do we need waterproof cases? Like, leave it outside.
I don't
like,
know.
Leave your OtterBox outside.
Brian Elledge, our non-millennial engineer.
Oh boy,
has a shower-proof phone apparently.
But it is like, it is sad. There are no spaces where, and you are expected to constantly be on email. And like, I mean, we get to the point where like people think it's unreasonable if you don't respond to an email in a day. Like, I think that's crazy.
I got an email this week from someone. She had emailed me last Wednesday, and on Monday she said, "Are you on an extended vacation? I have tried to email you 5 times." And I thought, can you imagine?
If only
30 years ago, this would not be a thing.
Yeah.
There was no out of office reply even back then.
Well, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to unplug more, to kind of have some quiet space, apparently deal with my existential crisis on my time.
That
on
sounds
my terms.
Like you're dealing with it, actually.
Yeah. So it's good to talk about.
Thanks for sharing.
Thanks.
But on another note, are you relieved that you got your colonoscopy and that all is well?
Yes, it's done. Listeners, it went well, went great. It went, you know, it's done, but it is important to do. And I've heard that from more and more people after going. It's something people don't talk about. You know, there was a blip when Katie Couric did it in 2000 on camera because her husband died at 42 of colon cancer. So it's important to do and good to do, but
I was kind of hoping your diagnosis was going to be like overconnected or anxiety due to overconnection.
That would have been poetic. Yeah.
His colon is fine, but he needs to get offline once in a while.
He needs to get off the phone. Yeah.
You can get more information about colon screening from the American Cancer Society's website, cancer.org. Chris, thanks for letting us use your colon to launch this fascinating conversation.
Thanks.
In the garden, digging the weeds, who could ask for more? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Let us move on to our touts. This is the portion of the show where each of us recommends one thing we are reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, eating. Did I already say that? No, I did not. Or just plain obsessed with. We're going to start with Lauren Smart, and the music you just heard indicates a Simpsons connection.
There is a Simpsons connection. So Stage West has a fabulous show on its stage right now called Mr. Burns, colon.
I was not going to do that.
You said colon.
Okay, Mr. Burns, colon, a post-electric play. And it's a new piece out of New York by a playwright named Anne Washburn. And basically the premise is that it's the end of the world. Nuclear power plants have combusted and a group of strangers gathers around a fire. And one of the ways they sort of pass time is retelling the Cape, or trying to retell the Cape Fear episode of The Simpsons. And it becomes this huge, like, that becomes a jumping off point for a play that is about storytelling and about theater making and about what unites us and what culture will stand the test of time. And in this play, one of the cultural artifacts that stands the test of time is The Simpsons.
I'm in.
I would support that, yeah.
Yeah, y'all should see it. It's really, really good.
Christopher.
That sounds amazing. And actually, Cape Fear plays into my tout because I have become obsessed a little bit more recently with the classic yuppie horror film. Think like Pacific Heights, Sleeping with the Enemy.
Just in general? You just watch them as a genre?
Well,
do you like watching yuppies like get terrified and killed? Is that part of it?
It started recently. I caught a bit of The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. Do you remember that one?
Rebecca De Mornay.
Rebecca De Mornay. And they're in that beautiful, gorgeous white house. And it made me suddenly think of all of the films that are like the gorgeous family in the beautiful house and the Volvo parked out front. And then
the stepfather.
And then evil comes in whatever form to, you know, disrupt their harmonious life. So I became obsessed with the house after seeing that. And I looked it up and I found a website that had the house from that movie and several others of the yuppie horror genre that I love. And it's called IamNotAStalker.com.
Okay.
IamNotAStalker.com, and it's a woman who started it as kind of the definitive source for filming locations. And so if you see a cool house or something in the movie, you can look it up and see what the real, you know, where it was done, where the real life house is, and often how they change it, which I thought was interesting. So for example, like Sleeping with the Enemy, there's that cute little bungalow that Julia Roberts escapes to in South Carolina. It's the exterior of one house and then the interior of a different one. Mm. They kind of cut and paste it and cobbled it all in together. But it's a fascinating way to spend 30 minutes and just sort of get absorbed and voyeuristically snooping around the country at houses and films.
I love the idea of having to remind yourself that you're not a stalker.
I am not a stalker.
I am not a stalker. I am not a stalker.
Say to yourself every morning when you wake up.
Yeah, totally.
You can do this and you are not a stalker.
I am not a stalker.
And people like me. Emma Court, what do you have?
So I just discovered the Paper Towns soundtrack, and it is excellent.
Such a millennial.
Didn't you go recently when they blew through town? Were you the one, Emma?
I didn't go to... There's an event where everyone from the film was going to be there, like John Green and all that stuff. So I got the fun task of going outside and interviewing the people who'd been in line for like hours and hours and hours.
In the heat.
In like the heat. But I got to leave and they didn't. So I felt like I was pretty lucky. But I just discovered the soundtrack. It's really good. There is a Vampire Weekend song on it, so that sort of sold me. But, like, the music is excellent. So kudos to whoever chose those songs, because good stuff.
Thumbs up.
My tout is a TV miniseries, which starts Sunday on HBO, which I just mainlined. I binge-watched it on my little HBO press website thing. It is called Show Me a Hero. It is created by David Simon, who made The Wire, which I consider probably the greatest TV series ever.
Phenomenal.
And I think this is the best work he's done since then. It's based on a true story, a nonfiction book by Lisa Belkin. And it's about a political crisis and showdown in Yonkers in the late 80s and early 90s revolving around public housing. So it looks at this public housing, this affordable housing crisis, and how it affects all of these different parties, especially the municipal politicians. The main guy is played by Oscar Isaac, who can just
do no wrong
right now. And this is about as good as anything I've seen him do. He almost seems like a young Al Pacino. He's got that kind of energy and presence. It's called Show Me a Hero, directed by Paul Haggis. Who is an Oscar winner for Crash a few years back.
Right.
And I think it's the best thing he's done in a while. Winona Ryder is in it. Jim Belushi.
Wow.
Interesting. Interesting to see Winona Ryder back.
Pretty interesting cast. I just loved it. It's going to play over the next few weeks on HBO starting Sunday night. Whole lot of Bruce Springsteen music in it as well. There's some hip-hop, which they actually select very well And then Bruce is just kind of layered throughout it. It's that part of the country. And the main character, Nick Wasisco, is a big Springsteen fan. So,
coincidentally, we have some Springsteen coming on now.
With that, we're going to take you out with Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. And I will tell you that you can find links to some of the things we've talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com, the entertainment website of the Dallas Morning News. Drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com or send us a tweet at mixedmediapod. You can now subscribe to Mixed Media on iTunes. Woo-hoo! Just search for our name, Mixed Media. The show is engineered by Brian Elledge and produced by Christopher Wynn. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode. Until then, for Christopher Wynn, Lauren Smart, and Emma Court, I am Chris Wagner, and we thank you for joining us.
I kill everything in my bed.